The Griot's Remedy provides short fiction, theatrical excerpts, and excerpts of fictional works, as well as references, links, or other knowledge resources strictly for informational and entertainment purposes only. Anything said or discussed on The Griot's Remedy, though offered by coaches and mental health professionals, should not be taken as a replacement for individual and personal direct medical, clinical, professional advice, diagnosis, or medical intervention. Do not take any action based on any of the content you hear on The Griot's Remedy. Doing so is not suggested, recommended, implied, or wise. Producers, hosts, coaches, and therapists featured on The Griot's Remedy from Book Loudly, a division of Pecan Tree Creative Solutions, cannot be held liable for any consequences of the same based on individual discretion. Accessing, listening to, engaging in any fashion does not create or constitute a person-to-coach or therapist-to-patient relationship with the producers, host, or panelists. The opinions, banter, and comments presented do not substitute for professional mental health, emotional health, medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Visit the podcast site at bookloudly@pecantreebooks.com for resources related to the themes highlighted in this segment.
Welcome to The Griot's Remedy, a Book Loudly production, part of Pecan Tree Creative Solutions. This is where authors, coaches, and mental health professionals gather around the mic to explore themes brought to life in fictional works. What will they pull out of their bag on this episode? Keep it locked right here to find out. Here is your host, author, publisher, and award-winning playwright, E. Claudette Freeman.
Welcome, 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 guys, to episode 2 of The Griot's Remedy. We are so excited. Hope you enjoyed episode 1. Remember, you can always drop comments, shoot us an email to let us know what you think of any episode. I am back. It is me, E. Claudette Freeman, and I am back with my girls, with the panelists for this first season of The Griot's Remedy. Ms. Renee Audrick is a board-certified professional life coach, counselor, author, and mediation and mindfulness trainer. She holds an MBA in business management and organization and has over 30 years of experience as a business professional with expertise in relationships, training, leadership, caregiving, and organization. She is the CEO of Meditational Moment Incorporated and Meditational Academy, which is a virtual mobile movement that has been established to counsel, educate, train, and inspire all individuals to incorporate mediation in their lives as a catalyst for God alignment. As a sought-after speaker, Renee has been noted as a voice of influence and encouragement of those needing to push past complacency into a place of purpose and destiny. And you can connect with her at meditationalmoment.com for bookings and appointments. And Wina Wise is our second panelist. Wina is a licensed couple and family therapist, certified professional coach, clinical writer, and public speaker in the DC metropolitan area. She's the owner of Covenant Counseling and Consultant and Covenant Coaching Academy, with over 15 years of experience helping individuals, couples, and families achieve the personal and relationship results they desire. Wina has earned the reputation of being a foremost authority on relationship repair. Her clinical advice is currently featured in over 15 mainstream publications, such as NBC News, Huffington Post, MSN Insider, and USA Today. Wina speaks to local, national, and international audiences about relationship education, trauma recovery, and the role of spirituality in modern-day relationships. And you can connect with her through her website, WinaCullins.com. And so we are going to jump into a piece today, ladies, that I don't want to say I'm excited about it because it's a difficult piece, but it's a piece that I think so many of us have unfortunately had to walk through with some of our friends. And this piece is called Tears of a Clown.
A circus of emotions lay about the big top. Anger mold in the torn curtains that now lay scattered at the foot of the window. Torment clothed the oak dining table that once was decorated by the shredded tablecloth. A tablecloth dismembered and distributed in various areas of the big top. And the chord of mayhem played in our heads as we noticed in disbelief that the elephant had placed his size 13 shoes through the VCR. The only thing more shocking than that was to see that he had used his massive trunk to topple the couch, the ottoman, the shattered glass coffee table. He had used his massive trunk to break through the TV screen. And he, even worse, used the trunk to shatter the crystal punch bowl that Aunt Jane got from Mama May, who got it from Grandy, who got it from Auntie Reen, who some say got it from a white lady when she bought her freedom. But history was only as important as it is right now. The Big Top, now the circus of her life, lay scattered before us. Like children marveled by the clowns, the animals, and the magic acts, we stood speechless, almost catatonic. It was not the first time we had seen his wrath, and it would not be the last. But I held my tongue, remembering the words that I had told her weeks before. I think he's going to kill you. I think you should leave him. And I think you should realize that if he kills you, killing your kids would mean nothing. She begged me to understand that he just sometimes became a different person. For the most part, he is the gentle soul that I first met. He is the gentleman that has joined she and I for dinner. He is the sweet writer with profound statements that amaze. His latest statement, as it were, sent a fierce stabbing sheet of ice through every nerve in my body. And it terrified me. The sheet of cold washing through me, the look of disgust and vengeance on her face. Knowing that all of this came about because we had chosen to go to the mall instead of a movie. In his mind, we had conjured up a pair of studs to romance us. She was having a lewd, lascivious, and obviously more freaky affair with the man in his mind than she was having with the man of the Big Top. We stood for what seemed like forever, just staring at the destruction, staring at his schizophrenic reaction to non-reality, and I said nothing, because I kept thinking about what I said to her days before. I think he's going to kill you, but whatever you decide, he's your husband, and I'll be here for you, even if it's to help you get away. I said too much. I'm not going to clean this mess up. Help me grab some clothes for me and the kids. I'll stay at Angela's house the rest of the week. She's still in New York. I can't believe he did that to my VCR and my TV. I just bought them, Moni. I just bought them. Don't worry about the house. We can replace them. Maybe not brand new, but we can replace them. She slowly slid down the wall, grabbing things from the floor, cleaning up what she couldn't clean up, trying to stop the river of pain that rushed from her eyes. I pulled her up reassuringly. Don't worry about this room. Let's just get some clothes and get out of here before he comes back. The circus continued in the bedrooms, like little midgets piled into the makeshift Volkswagen. The children's clothes were piled neatly in a bundle on the bed, and they had been ripped into pieces. Nothing hung in the closets. The string and tongues had been cut from their shoes like someone was crazy. To me, it seemed like he was laughing at what his rape would do to her. Then something happened. I looked in Val's eyes and the tears turned into billowing flames shooting from a burning heart and engulfed soul. Val, come on now. As stupid as this sounds, you've got to calm down. That is the damn problem, Moni. I am calm. So calm that I am going to get into my car. I'm going to pick up my kids and put them on a plane to their father. Then I'm going to my storage unit, reach into that top drawer, and I'm going to take out my legally registered handgun and blow that son of a no. I'm trying to stop cussing. I'm going to politely blow the gentleman away. Wherever I find his Wherever I find him is where I'm going to drop him. Before I could respond, she was on a dash for the door, a smoke trail of confusion, fear, and anger drifting behind her. Val, you are not thinking. Lord knows at this point I can see him dead too, but baby, you can't do this. Girl, are you listening to me? Moni, you are such a rational woman, and yes, I do hear you. But this day, I'm going to kill his selfish... No. I'm trying to stop cussing. Val, you've got three kids. As much as I love them, if you go to jail or end up dead, I can't do three kids. She continued to storm through the house, rearranging the disarray into disarray, not really paying me any mind. Val, I grabbed her arm. Listen to me. You cannot just storm out of here and go kill somebody, not even him. They will put you into jail. They do that in Florida, you know. He's already killed me, Moni. Have you looked at this house? Have you looked at this scar lately? Screaming and crying again, she tore apart her shirt. I had not seen the scar lately, but why would I? Val never wore sexually attractive clothing anymore. It was the reason for the scar. Chauncey methodically poured scalding water about her waistline one night as she lay in bed. The inner turmoil driving him to seduce his wife, leave her panting in bed from satisfaction, place a single red rose beside her sweat-drenched hair, and then trickle the boiling water down on her. She had worn a short t-shirt over her sports bra to the gym, her slim and tight waist exposed for all to see. No one would want to see the scar from a third-degree burn. No, I had not seen that scar lately, but I had seen far too many of his others, including the one before us now. I know you're hurting, Val, and I'm not going to even tell you that I know what you're feeling, because I don't. But I know that you can't let him pull you down to his level. Don't let him take your life and take you away from those kids. You're the only thing they know. You are their center. You are. Stop throwing shit around and listen to me. Shut up, Moni. Shut up. Shut up. Don't tell me about my kids. What do you think they feel about their mommy? I'm telling them straight up it's all right for somebody to beat you like a wild dog. If they say, sorry, love you, I can't do this anymore, I'd rather go to jail, Moni, than to live like this one more day. I've moved 3 times in the last 2 months. It does you no good to move, Val, if you let him in. If you give him a key, if you ignore the restraining order, you can't believe that he can sexually be with you, that you can keep having sex with him to calm him down. That is not calming him down. That is not calm. This is not calm, Val. This is demonic. And don't think he's not waiting for you to come for him. Think, baby, please. You have got to maintain your sanity for me right now. I'm scared, Val. Don't jump out of the frying pan into the fire. It won't matter, Moni. I've already been burned. Val and Chauncey had met at Miami-Dade Community College. They ended up in an English course together. Val switched to a night class because of her work schedule. We both thought it was kind of cute the way Chauncey had left cards and single roses with all of the night teachers looking for Val. He didn't know her name, but he left a very detailed description with each card. Finally, after about 3 weeks of cards and roses and no response, Chauncey showed up and waited in a corridor hoping to find Val, and he did. From that point on, it was a seemingly normal relationship, exceedingly romantic, almost to the point of sickening. But then I was the one without a man at the time, so anything would have seemed romantically sickening to me. Val was impressed by him, and why not? He was charming, good-looking, with a teddy bear smile and a warm embrace, intelligent and always willing to engage you in the most interesting conversations. He had a way with children. He had a way with Val. Everything that glitters ain't gold. That is what Val's Aunt Jane's opinion of Chauncey was from the beginning. She had a wisdom of abusive men that we were not aware of. One that Val ignored, but one that I found frightening and intriguing. I couldn't let it go. Val never paid it any attention. Monica, in the 7 years I've known Aunt Jane, she's always called me by my actual name. No matter how I begged her not to or how I explained that I didn't like the name, I am Monica to her. Valise don't see that boy for what he is, but I can feel it. He is just as evil as he is sweet. The very Bible says you can't serve two masters, and he does. Auntie, Val says he's the best thing she's ever had. He seems to be good for her. What is it that has you so scared of him? You get a chill in front of him. Before you even see him, you feel him. That's evil. It sits quiet, stirring up on the inside, and then it tears you up. I know what I'm talking about. I tell you, he's going to take her away from you, from me, from them kids, and then it's going to be too late. Why don't you tell Val? You can't tell a woman about her man, especially when she figure her man's stuff don't stink. When men have head problems, they fix things up real good. They tell you all the right things, cry at all the right times, cook clean, love you to death. 'Cause when the evil show up, They know what makes you weak, and that's what they use to beat your ass the next time. I don't think I'd ever heard it put quite that way before. But she was right. We don't listen to each other when it comes to our man. We know him better. We feel him better. We got it working better. We never even see that fist slamming into our face. Val has been blind for so long, and the sight that she had finally been given has taken her to a dangerous place. Tumbling about the floor, we looked like two rug rats on spring break, but I couldn't let her leave in such rage and such pain. That was a dangerous place for her to be emotionally and mentally. So we wrestled on the ground and she fought me for control of those keys. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I kept asking, why didn't you fight him like this? Why? Suddenly, I felt a gripping about my neck and I was flung across the room. We never even saw Chauncey come in. He pulled Val up from the floor by her neck, pinning her to a wall. He held her screaming, my father, which art in heaven, what do I do? What do I do? Lord, I take it. I grabbed a butcher's knife from the kitchen, touching him on the back with it so that he knew, so that I knew I would cut him. And he dropped her. Val slid down the wall, hitting out at him. Trying to find her breathing again, she gasped for me to run. But I couldn't leave her there. He was going to kill her. Chauncey, you need to leave. Get out of here or I'll call the police. I yelled, waving the knife before him. He never even acknowledged me. He fell to the couch and broke into tears. That was enough for me. I said, get out, Chauncey. Nobody wants to hear your sad story, your twisted version. I want you out now. Val grappled to get up from the floor, slipping back to her knees, not once but twice, before she finally rose, still trying to get her breath. What the hell is wrong with you, man? Look at my home. My kids have to come to this. He never looked up. Don't you even care? Don't you realize what you've done? With his face buried in his hands, he mumbled. Nothing at first, then slowly. Valise, I love you. But your friends come between us. I get crazy. I'm sorry, Val. I'm sorry. Val stared at him. In a split second, something in her demeanor let me know that this was not the last time this circus would be in town. Still, the mess of the present time upon her, she chose to protect herself. You're right, Chauncey. You are sorry. You are a sorry excuse for a man. I don't know why I love you so. There was victory for Chauncey in the confession of love, and Val didn't even know it. She motioned for me, and as we headed for the front door, he lunged at Val, grabbing her arm. And with one quick motion, I landed the knife across his upper arm. He yanked away. You see, Val? This is what I'm talking about. I just wanted to hold you. Val ran out the front door, leaning against the car. She began to throw up everything that filled her. Evil is a sickening thing. 2 weeks and one more incident later, Val and Chauncey were back together. And he had achieved what Aunt Jane feared. Val no longer dealt with her. The kids were safe with their father in the Carolinas. Val and I rarely spoke. One of the last times we did, she very politely chastised me for cutting Chauncey. I said nothing. In the midst of a sermon one day, I heard the pastor say that there are some battles that you are just not to be involved in. Some turmoil cannot be solved on earth. I think Chauncey's turmoil is of a supernatural nature. I think Val has become part of a dangerous sorority. In the midst of Chauncey's world, she ceased being the strong, super-intelligent, independent fighter that I have known for years. When she did, his battle was won. And when he needed to beat up on somebody that he knew would not fight back, she was there. I would call her. She would not talk. I would tell her I pray for her. She would laugh, saying, girl, I need it. Her bill collectors would call me looking for her. He was apparently spending all of the money, and she had had several beatings about bill collectors or boyfriends calling the house. Then I finally had enough of our relationship. One of us had to let go of Chauncey, and since I was not his wife, it had to be me. Letting go of him meant letting go of Val as well. That hurt. There were times when the rain would beat slowly against my window that I would see her battered face or hear her screaming. Then I would call, and she would not talk. I let go of Val. You know, you can extend your hand to someone but for such a time. and then you let go. Your arms grow weary and tired, and eventually they fall back into their rightful place, and the thing that you reached for will slip away. It had been a year, and I had not seen Val or Chauncey, and Aunt Jane had only seen her in spells, mainly when she was not bruised and when she was broke and had nowhere else to turn. When her pride had taken its last breath, she stayed hid, and I finally stopped trying to find her. What else could I do? Loving her meant hating him, meant losing her. But I never said anything. So for everything I never said, Val, Valise, standing here holding on to this cold hospital metal rail, know that I will be right here for you. I felt a comforting hand on my shoulder, and the nurse urged me to get a cup of coffee or lay down in the nurse's lounge, but I was afraid to leave her again. No, she didn't know I was there. No, she didn't know she was there, but I was afraid to leave her again. As the IV dripped slowly into her nearly lifeless body, I saw her on her wedding day singing "You Bring Me Joy" to a man that would destroy her. For everything I never said, Val, let me say this. May you know in your next life that joy need never mean pain. I love you.
Wow, kind of heavy piece, yeah?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So many things in here. I jotted down a lot of stuff, but I'm gonna throw it to you, ladies. But beyond the physical abuse, clearly there was some emotional abuse and some financial abuse, because the story talks about how the money was gone, and she had to go to her aunt. So yeah, so just so much to unpack, right? My head is just like all over the place right now. So yeah, weigh in. There's a lot here.
Mm. Renee, do you want to start?
Well, you know, it's definitely a heavy story in that, you know, just listening to just all that Val had to go through, just in the start. Like in the start, she was feisty and ready to kill him. And it was, you know, I'm going to make my stand. And then to watch the transformation of the story when she somehow, you know, lost herself and went back and allowed the cycle to repeat itself. And so, you know, just being in that place where, you know, how do you get there where you allow someone else to, you know, beat on you and to torture you in such a way that you feel a fight, but then you lose the fight. You feel a fight. And so that's had to be a cycle that she continued to repeat, because her friend was there. You know, her friend was there through the whole time, seeing, you've gone too far. You don't want to take it that far. But here you are in this place and you see it. And so let me help you to get out. But then she never makes the move. And so that, just seeing how many times do we see that cycle, you know, do we hear of people staying in situations and circumstances that are not good for them, that are toxic, that are hurtful, that are painful. And we see them continue to allow, you know, the things of the other person to cause them to revert back and to give up themselves to, you know, stay in this place.
Yes. I know this is going to be one of my favorite pieces of the season. Yeah. It was so artfully written, because mm-hmm. as a clinician, when I look at all of the subtle ways that the abuse cycle was captured in this piece, I thought, whoever wrote this, Claudette, I mean, really knew her stuff.
Yes.
Really knew her stuff.
Yes. Yes.
I want to start off by talking about how so often we see the potential in people and we attach ourselves to that potential and that outcome. And it can sometimes be our fatal flaw. Mm-hmm. Instead of seeing the entire person or being unattached to the outcome in a way that allows you to see things for what they really are, or to mm-hmm. see the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And in this piece, it was never a truer statement said when, from the aunt's perspective, she mentioned they literally front load the relationship, and I'm talking about an abuser, mm-hmm. with positivity, mm-hmm. and they will love bomb you and come in riding on a white horse like mm-hmm. Prince Charming or mm-hmm. a princess who is there to be your savior or your knight in shining armor. Because when the darkness hits, it's already going to be hard for you to see beyond the foundation that they laid. Mm-hmm. So these mm-hmm. are not fools. People who end up in domestic violence situations are often some of the most intelligent, rational, resilient people. And that light is what attracts abusers and predators mm-hmm. to them. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they literally come in knowing who they are. They're typically supportive and empathic. They actually have a heart for other people's stories and trauma, and a predator or an abuser will use that to prey wow. on.
Mm-hmm.
So they set you up by telling you all of the things that will pull at your heartstrings
mm-hmm.
and make you feel very much connected to them and want to help in any way that you can. And they will charm you. They will have a way with kids. They will do anything that they can to make people around you also believe that they are a good person for you. So that when something bad happens, even your community around you can be fooled at times. Now, yeah. Val had some people around her who were able to see through it. It seemed like her mm-hmm. aunt had been through something, you know, like that, and was able to feel that love bombing in the beginning and know that that was a mask that Chauncey was wearing. And mm-hmm. Moni had walked in enough with Val to see that no matter how good he was or what he was bringing, this isn't it for you.
That's right.
Right.
Right. It was such an amazing piece.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that as you were talking, Weena, that it's almost like, you know, okay, I watch a lot of crime shows, y'all. I don't know why. But it's almost like this would be somebody they profiled on like one of those behavioral, you know, in mm-hmm. the behavioral analyst yeah, unit, absolutely. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's almost like this person can be a serial abuser. You know, when, mm-hmm. when you take that much time to think about how you're going to get close to someone,
mm-hmm.
you basically show up in almost every relationship that way, or you have the potential to show up in every relationship that way with the goal of at some point physically hurting someone.
Yeah.
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 So is that a matter of narcissistic behavior or control, or mm-hmm. is that some form of mental illness? Or all of the above.
Exactly.
All of the above.
Exactly. And I love where this is going, because mm-hmm. if we don't do anything today, I want us to help people understand that while there is a clinical diagnosis for what we just heard, and the behaviors sound so heinous that you can sometimes think, yeah, that happens to other people. Those subtle forms of manipulation and behavior are lurking around you. And we are rubbing elbows mm-hmm. with that element often, or many of us have had situations where we have entertained someone who has narcissistic tendencies or abusive tendencies, mm-hmm. and we didn't know what to look for. We absolutely didn't realize where that came from, or that there were pieces of those behaviors in a cycle that might have been brewing underneath the surface. And for whatever reason, we just didn't know that there was a label for it. So yes, the signs that we heard and hear were absolutely the love bombing, like I said, mm-hmm. and then there was a calculation of control. I mm-hmm. heard Moni say that this all started, this particular tirade that he'd went on where he busted up everything in the house because they told him initially that they were going to see a movie and they ended up just going to the mall.
Mm-hmm.
And right. just that shift in the yeah. plans caused mm-hmm. his insecurity to escalate so yes. much.
Maniacally.
Absolutely. Yes. She said yes. that he'd cut the shoestrings. He had mm-hmm. gotten into a space where it was like the Tasmanian devil had just
mm-hmm. yeah.
run amok in the house, right?
Yes.
Right. And he wanted to send a very clear message that she could not, and by she, I mean Val, change plans or deviate without letting him know, or there would be consequences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that level of control, when it gets exerted, comes from a place of deep insecurity
yes.
in the abuser.
Yes.
Deep insecurity. And yes. they mask that insecurity on the front end by coming across as the most generous, thoughtful, and oftentimes tolerant person to gain your trust and make you feel comfortable and make you believe that you know exactly who they are and that this person wouldn't hurt a fly.
Yeah. Until they heard a fly.
Absolutely.
And, you know, one of the things that struck me with the way that he had gone into the kids' room and even destroyed the kids' stuff, mm-hmm. I think, you know, even though I wrote this piece, it's interesting you write something and then when you hear it back years later, you pick up on so many different things. But
sure.
that piece kind of shook me. It gave me goosebumps because I'm thinking, oh, my God, if you would do something like that to those children's belonging, I would be horribly afraid that your abuse of me would not be enough.
Yes, yeah. that eventually, yeah,
it would eventually you right mm-hmm. into the kid. Yep. And I think that somewhere in Val, she probably suspected that as well, which is probably why she chose to send them away. But part mm-hmm. of me also wonders, why would you choose to send them away and not rescue yourself?
Right. That's absolutely right. And I think because a lot, you know, I love what Wina said about the lurking, the predator lurking. And when he lurks, he's watching and he's looking for those spaces where he can reach your vulnerability. And so yes. her space of not leaving is like, okay, I'm going to protect the children, but I'm strong enough. I can handle it. And then every time that she made a decision or that she was about to do something different, he cried, you know, or he, you know, said it's only because of your friends. Or he started to, you know, he redirected, yeah. you know, her right. anger in the moment.
Yeah.
To, you know, what about me? But you're forgetting about me, but I love you. And look at how I make you feel. And so he wanted to draw her and to, you know, we really sit on that space, you know, that space where, you know, this is what you've given up for me. And so why are you filling it with something else? You know, I need you. And even her friend saw, you know, we don't want to see your tears. Like, why are you just crying? Wipe right. it up, get it together, you know. But right. even in that, she started to break. She started to, you know, say, okay, well, you know what? I'm going to let this situation ride itself out and I'm going to tend to him. And so that's what the predator does. That's what the lurker does. That's what that person with that control issue does. He constantly, you know, draws you back to the love. What about us? You know, I should be first.
Yeah.
Renee, yeah. I love what you said about how she sent the kids away, but she stayed and thought, I'm strong enough to mm-hmm. handle this. Narcissists and abusers pay attention to what you do, not uh-huh. what you say.
Yes, absolutely.
So you may say that you're leaving, you're fed up, you're not tolerating this anymore, but what they see is that you stayed. Every time mm-hmm. you decide that you're going to stay, even though you believe there's nuance to it, I'm staying, but something has to be different, you are reinforcing for them that you will tolerate any Absolutely. Boundary that they push, mm-hmm. anything that they want from you, and ultimately they don't see that nuance that you think is there. It's black and white for them.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
That's
so true.
That's, you know, wow. And I remember that part in the story where he says, you know, it's your friends come between us. I'm crazy, you know. And I'm listening to that and I'm like, okay, he's laying out to you all of the reasons he's going to continue to be who he is. I'm going to continue to do this because you're friends. I'm going to continue to do this because I'm crazy.
Yeah.
Right. And yet it's very interesting to me because when you said some of the most intelligent, practical people end up in these types of relationships.
Yeah.
Because I think that the first sign or warning, we kind of just blow it over, we gloss over it. And I remember that there would be different people, different older women in my life growing up and in my family that would always say, the first time he puts his hands on you should be the last time he does.
That's right.
Right. And it's very interesting because this piece came to mind. For some reason, I was watching an old rerun of the TV show Good Times the other day. Mm-hmm. And it was an episode where Florida had gone to some women's support group and James was up in arms about it and they were having a big argument about it or whatever. And he said something to her and I'm saying, okay, I don't know that I ever really paid attention to that, but it struck a chord for me. He said to her, you keep flying off at the lip or something. If you keep doing it, I'm going to punch you in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I thought to myself, okay, now, I mean, in the history of the show, you never saw him get violent with her, but I'm thinking for a person in a real relationship, that should have been something that gave you alarm.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, I'm like this, y'all. If you tell me mm-hmm. you can hit me or you will hit me, I'm going to take you at your word.
Yeah.
Have to talk about investment here, though, because people who end up staying past the first sign and past the second sign and they end up being in these physical altercations are not fools.
Mm-mm.
They weigh the cost of their investment.
Mm.
And a predator is literally hoping that by the time the abuse shows up, the investment that they have purposefully made in gaining your trust, in getting you to a place of financial dependency, mm-hmm. of winning over your children, is going to be enough to make you think twice.
Yes.
After they've done something to hurt you. Yes. It's all very calculated and you won't see it coming because the average person is not thinking that anyone would put this much bandwidth into manipulation.
Oh, absolutely mm-hmm. not. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can barely conceive of a person spending this much time and energy thinking about ways that they can control, manipulate, and get you into a space of dependency to the point where you would need to stay when their worst qualities show up. But those people do very much exist. They've been hurt. They've been traumatized. Mm-hmm. And it shows up in such subtle ways in the beginning that rarely does it just start with the fist to the mouth. Mm-hmm. It may start mm-hmm. with confusing comments, gaslighting, yes. which is yes. what we saw Chauncey do when he flipped mm-hmm. the script and said, mm-hmm. see your friends don't like me or they're not good for you. That's gaslighting. That is making the person test their reality of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a person will say, no, it wasn't me. You're not seeing this situation correctly. It was them.
Right.
It was something else. You
right.
know that this happened for a good reason. And if you have even an ounce of love or investment in that personal relationship, you will take a step back
yep.
and objectively consider what they're mm-hmm. saying and mm-hmm. try to take your part into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately you'll say, oh, well, you know what? They may have a point. Mm-hmm. I carry some of that blame. And the minute you do that, and it's hard for you to let them own all of it, that's the minute you slip farther down that slippery slope.
Yeah. And they win. And, you know, it just goes back to really just allowing yourself to not be afraid. You know, we get in a place where once you settle, once you start to receive and accept the circumstance, then, like you said, the investment, then you're fearful to move forward. You're fearful to let it go. You're fearful to lose. You know, all of that, that fear starts to surface, and then that causes you to stay. Like, you know what, if I lose this, if I lose my house, you know, all of the right. investment that was strategically set up to make you feel like you can't make it by yourself.
That's right.
Without me. That's not right. even by yourself, but without me, the abuser. You can't make it without me, but you really can. But they set it up in such a way that you're so fearful that if I don't have him, if I don't have his income, if I don't have, you know, the car that he gave me, if I don't have all of these things.
Right.
But, you know, I believe it was one of the arguments that her and Val went back and forth and said, we can leave all of this stuff. Like, yeah. The stuff doesn't matter, but your life does. I believe that he's going to kill you. So we have to realize that stuff can't keep us, that words shouldn't keep us, we have to realize there's so much value in who we are that we can allow that to cause us to forget.
Let's take a quick break here, ladies, and then we'll come back and finish this conversation because there's just a lot here.
When you were young, you'd scribble a story on notebook paper and proudly read it to an audience of stuffed animals. Just like that, you planted the seed of being a published author. Let that vision grow with Pecan Tree Publishing, a self-publishing company designed by authors for authors. Pecan Tree Publishing works with authors in an array of genres and our inclusive packages featuring editing, printing, publicity, and marketing. Get additional information at www.pecantreebooks.com.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
This is how we do every day.
If you love them enough to turn off your music and pretend like their music is your music.
Ah, this is mommy's jam.
Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're in the right car seat.
Let's play it again.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
We hope you are enjoying the show so far. Let's dive back into the Griot's Remedy from Book Loudly, a division of Pecan Tree Creative Solutions. And remember, you can always drop a comment on our Facebook or Instagram page. Look for Pecan Tree Pub.
And we're back. We're continuing our conversation, episode 2, Tears of a Clown, talking about domestic violence, or as it's more commonly called now, intimate partner violence. And going back to what you ladies were talking about before we went into the break about how there's this very manipulative setup of everything. It's the, you know, it's the, oh, you're beautiful. I'm going to buy you flowers. I'm going to buy you material things. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And then if I say something that should set off a red flag, you may pause for a moment, but oh, you know what? I'm going to say it. And as soon as I say it, I'm going to buy you something else. And for me, it kind of reminds me of the line that Moni says in the piece where she talks about the fact that they were, and the house is all torn up and everything. And she said that they were rearranging the disarray into disarray.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds to me like that's what happens in a lot of abusive, especially physically, and I would imagine other types of abusive relationships too. You, instead of trying to remove yourself from the situation, you spend a lot of time rearranging their disarray into what just becomes more disarray.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you develop these learned behaviors. Moni also mentioned you can't have sex with him to calm him down. And that's a good example of a coping strategy that a survivor might adopt, that you start to notice what sets that person off. And for the sake of keeping the peace, you become quieter, or you have sex with them to calm them down, or you check in so much more because you know that if you don't check in, they're going to be insecure and start to accuse you of going off and doing things that are inappropriate. You're absolutely right. You reorder your life to walk on eggshells in a sense. And sometimes you don't even realize that you're holding your breath. You don't realize that you're reordering your life around this person's need for control because you two don't have a discussion about that. It's just something that you start to do to keep the beast from raging.
Wow.
And that's so true. You know, it becomes habit. It becomes habitual. And then you, because it's such a habit, it doesn't even become feel not normal. You know, and so you move in this way. Now you're moving in as a robot. Like, if this happens, then I do that. It's a robotic movement, and you're so stuck. And until you start to recognize the rut that you've created, the rut that you've allowed to manifest, then you're not going to be able to move past or get out of it. And so many of us, you know, find ourselves in those situations where that abuser has restructured our thought pattern in such a way that we have become less and they've become the more of our life, the more of what we thrive for, the more of what we do. And here we are becoming this minuscule person that really don't even exist anymore.
I was going to throw something really interesting in here because the role of marriage in general, taking those vows and what society tells us they're supposed to mean and what happens when we quit, how we see that, if it's a failure or not, also plays a huge part sometimes in sticking around for some of these behaviors that that cause so much harm. When you think, okay, this was supposed to be the forever commitment, and you've got a community of people around you who believe that if you leave, you are failing or giving up.
Right.
Then even that will give you moments pause to take a second or a third thought when you find yourself in a situation like this. Even subtle things like from a gender perspective in heterosexual relationships, if a wife is being a good wife, isn't her husband's supposed to take up that space? Isn't he supposed to potentially become the center of her world? And if she reorders her life around him in certain ways, it's very difficult sometimes to distinguish between what's healthy and what your definition of marriage is.
And I think, you know, thinking about the, you know, the idea of marriage and this woman and this man. And so we have to come together being whole. We have to come together, you know, knowing who we are and knowing what value that we hold over ourselves before we can add value, because marriage is added value. You know, we add value to each other. And so when, you know, one end becomes toxic, when it becomes unrecognizable, when it becomes ugly, then you're no longer adding value. Right. So we have to come into a place where, okay, what this picture is not looking the same. And regardless of what others think, regardless of what others depict as a failed marriage, is not what this is looking like. This is looking like there's something going on. And whether it's, if it ends in failure or not, I'm not going to tolerate what's going on now. I'm going to show up differently because I want something different. I'm not going to continue to take the abuse. I'm not going to continue to allow myself to be invisible, because that's what happens in that toxic relationship. You become invisible and that person becomes the one, the one. the two that should become one, now it's really the one.
Just that one.
And is mm-hmm. that the way it should be established? And so we have to be so careful to continue to, you know, assess, okay, is this relationship good for me or just good?
And
or
I think
it good for me.
I think that also needs to be the case in dating relationships, because there is so much research, yes, and so much, you know, where this type of violence or this type of abuse is happening in dating relationships. I remember a few mm-hmm. months ago, I have a niece in high school, and she asked me to edit an essay for her. And part of the essay was talking about different programs that she would like to see them begin in school. And the program that she wanted them to begin was something to help high school students deal with domestic violence, not from their parents, but from the relationships that they're in with other high school students.
Oh, yeah.
And oh my God, oh my gosh, when I read it, I was just like,
oh yeah,
I was just like, oh no, yeah, you know, forget the editing the essay. We're going to have a conversation
talk
right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because that frightened me to think that here you have a student in high school that is so concerned and seeing it happen so much with her friends and with others in the school that she thinks the school needs to create a program.
Yeah, but it's all about boundary testing. Mm-hmm. From a very young age, when we enter romantic relationships, we are untrained.
Yeah,
we are absolutely untrained in the art of learning how to come alongside another person and care for them with thoughtfulness. And so when you find yourself in those relationships, depending on the things that you've seen, heard, or the things that no one has bothered to tell you about how to be in a space with another person, you will test boundaries. And that includes potentially being verbally abusive, putting your hands on each other mm-hmm. in ways that are absolutely harmful and toxic. And if you're not talking about it, it stays among your peers. Your parents and caregivers don't even get wind of it until somebody gets hurt or it gets leaked on social media. So this is not an uncommon practice. And that's why I advocate so much for relationship education in a way that is so different from the way we normalize it today and teach people.
Yeah.
What type of relationship education should we be providing for young people? Because again, that was just, it was just shocking for me.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, we're giving kids the bare bones sometimes when we're talking about the birds and bees and how babies mm-hmm. are made, right?
Mm-hmm. So we do the sex and pregnancy talk.
We do the sex and pregnancy talk for sure. And sometimes we'll do the domestic violence talk, meaning, you know, don't talk to a person this way, or absolutely, right, if someone puts their hands on you, don't let that happen.
Right.
But even things like, how do you know how to read cues from someone that lets you know that they're giving you consent to even hold their hand?
Yes.
We do not talk to our children about becoming more emotionally aware, not only of themselves, mm-hmm. but of other people. And mm-hmm. often it's because we didn't get the talk, and there's not necessarily a book written on it yet. Mine is coming out. But but the point is that those very nuanced talks about how we are supposed to study other people and really invest in their emotional health. Mm-hmm. And then therefore that trickles down to how you treat them physically and how you just lay a really good, safe foundation for sexual exploration, for building emotional intimacy and trust.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just not happening yet, but that's what needs to happen.
Yeah. And I believe, you know, a lot of times, you know, the way that people act and the way that they project, even from a young age, is a product of the environment that they're around. You know, if their parents were verbally abusive, if their, you know, parents were even physically abusive, then they start to amass those type of behaviors in their lives, even in the relationships that they have. And so how do we guard our children? We guard them by teaching them, you know, how to recognize you know, seeds of guilt that people will try to place on you if you're not my friend. Mm-hmm. You know, signs of controlling, you know, behavior and controlling behavior when you got to check in with a friend for nothing, you know, no reason at all. And,
yes.
You know, jealousy that surfaces in relationships, you know, when a friend is constantly jealous because you're doing this and you're doing that, because those behaviors, you know, may start very young and continue on. And we hear even now that domestic violence is in that boyfriend and girlfriend relationship. You know, they're starting very, very young. And so the way that we guard our children is really showing them and telling them about the different things that may come up. These are the things you look out for. We teach them about, you know, people touching them physically. We teach them about, you know, we prepare them in other ways, but we don't prepare them for the attacks of the mind, the attacks that make you think that you're less than, make you think that you have to do what I say, that make you think, you know, these things that are not right. And so just like we do with the outer things that you can see, we need to train them for the inner things that the enemy may try to, you know, come into your mind and cause you to act differently or do differently.
One of the things, ladies, that I definitely want us to talk about, because and I know this young lady, and she shared her story in a book we did a couple of years ago called Beyond the Pretty Dress, where women talked about how they ended up moving into ministry or ministering in different perspectives based on their story. And her story is about domestic violence. She married someone, and she's from a prominent family, married from a prominent family, intelligent girl, mm-hmm. married someone, and originally it was beautiful. And then the violence showed up. And once the mm-hmm. violence showed up, she went to what she thought would be a safe space to share what was going on. And that was a women's ministry at her church.
Mm-hmm. Oh, bring it. Come on. Let's do it.
And the women's ministry made her feel like all of the abuse was her fault and that it was not reason for her to leave her husband.
She
stayed in an abusive relationship.
Mm. I'm so glad somebody else said it.
Yes.
That is victim shaming. And
it is.
Victim shaming is when we literally place blame on the person who has been abused for whatever reason. And sometimes we don't even know that we're doing it. We can do it subtly by asking certain questions like, well, what were you wearing? Well, what did you say first? What did you do? Which asserts that maybe we were being provocative. We brought that on. We pulled that behavior out in the person. Mm-hmm. And it shifts the focus from the person's need to be able to control themselves and do work on themselves. And like I said earlier, when we're talking to people that we love and trust, and they plant a seed of doubt in our head or ask certain questions or assert certain things, it makes us step back and question, well, did I play a part in that? Is there something that I could have done differently? And as soon as we start to share that blame, we then lose some of the energy that we need to focus on getting ourselves to a better space mentally and potentially leaving the situation.
I agree. And I think that, you know, going back to sitting in the women's circle, we as the voice have to be careful. We have to be careful that we don't say things that will really harm the individual in being able to trust what we give them and then don't move. And because of that, so the blood is on our hands. We have to be mindful about what we're saying, even though we may think, you know, what the word tells us about being submissive and, you know, this is what we need to do in order to have this right relationship according to this thing we created, this box we created for life and for marriage. But we need to realize that toxicity is not welcome in any way. It should not be welcome. It should not be accepted. It should not be received. It's not something that we wear as a mantle on of our shoulders, but it is something that we have to see. It's not good. So right. Us as truth tellers, us as the women who believe, us as even the women's circle, we have a responsibility to see things as they are and speak life and not death over people's situation. Speak truth and encouragement and realize that we don't want them to suffer. And if there is suffering there, then we have to be able to impart some love and some kindness and say, you know what? This is not the way it should be. This is not how God intended it for you to be lost, for you to be hurting day in and day out, for you to be in pain internally and externally.
Right. And one of the things, and that was part of her story, and you mentioned it, Renee, was submission. That was one of the things the women talked to her about. You must submit to your husband. And I think that especially, I mean, I'm that's a whole nother episode, but I think we totally, misunderstand that whole submission piece. But when it comes to using that in a, like you were saying, in a victim shaming perspective, or even an abuser who may be, a spiritual or Christian person, using that as admonishment or some type of scolding you to remain in the behavior because you need to be submissive. Yeah. You're not being submissive. Submission is not enforced here. That's a dangerous thing.
For us to be truth tellers, we first have to be truth seekers. And being a truth seeker on a spiritual level is a game of chess. It's not checkers in any way. You have to be very careful even about the messages that you're receiving in church or when you're sitting under a certain type of leadership. I've had plenty of old leaders at churches get up in the pulpit and say that the only reason for divorce that's legitimate is adultery, right? And you're sitting amongst thousands of parishioners knowing that some types of abuse, whether it's emotional, financial, or physical, are happening. And even in those one-on-one counseling sessions with pastor or the elders or the deacons, they're saying, above all things, even when these domestic disputes pop off, how can we work this out? How can we work this out? Yeah. And they're literally fighting for that relationship to the death. And it sends a message that you should fight to stay, not fight to leave. It's very difficult to overcome some of those messages that we get as women and even as men in the church. But what I love about the Proverbs 31 woman is that she's not only a woman who's absolutely for her husband and for her children, but she buys a field and she makes sure that her businesses are profitable. She's doing things to have a level of independence and a level of stature that allows her to be whole. And so if something were to be amiss in that relationship, she would then potentially be okay because she has her own life skills. She's self-sufficient. Yes. She's able to do. But when we get into spaces where we become so dependent in relationships on our partner, that's where it becomes gray. It's not black and white. Leaving is sometimes chess. It's not checkers. You can walk away with your 1, 2, 3, or 4 children if you like. But when you get into the courts, and you're trying to prove that you should be able to have half custody and you can't support them financially or you don't have a roof for them to be under, that's the type of thing that makes people think critically about whether or not they can actually leave because they're giving up something or they know that they might have something revoked that really, really matters to them. So this is not an easy situation to find yourself in, and you absolutely have to seek wisdom, and timing is everything. Yes. It is everything.
Yeah. And I think that answers the question that Moni kind of posed to herself, in the story where she says she wonders why didn't she fight him? You know, the way she was fighting her to get to get loose from her to go get, you know, her weapon. She wondered, why didn't she fight him with that same kind of force? But, and then she talks about how she could tell when Valise's energy shifted based on what he was saying, that it was not going to be the end of things again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that I think that kind of answers that question, Weena, based on what you and Renee are saying, is that you lose yourself, two, you have to figure out, can I be okay?
Yeah.
Can I be okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I like to piggyback off of what Weena said, and, you know, really calculating the cost.
Yeah.
You know, you get to a place where you realize, okay, this is, something is not right, but I am not right in the fact that I can't take care of myself. Yes. I don't have the right resources. I may not be able to provide for my children. And so when Weena said timing is everything, and that's when you have to create a plan.
That's right.
You have to create a plan of escape. You know what? This is how it is, but I've finally seen the light. I've seen the light, but in seeing that light, I realized there's some things that I have to do. There's some things that I have to change. There's some things that I have to get in position in order to be able to make this move and to run for my life.
Yes.
But I have to be able to make a life. I be able to provide, you know, if I have children. And so timing and planning, you know, when you're in that state where I can't leave tomorrow. Because if I leave tomorrow, I'm literally going to be in a place of nothingness.
I forfeit nothingness
everything. And no value. And you know, some of us really need to have things or something in order to make us feel as though we can go forward. So creating all of that, how do I start my bank account? How do I, you know, having things set in place, having that friend to keep that secret stash until you're able to move. I'm setting things up in order.
Yeah. Let's talk about that, creating a plan. But let's take a quick break first, and then let's come back and talk about that, creating a plan.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
For every person who's experienced a challenging relationship with their mother, for every child who's ever questioned why their mom was not there, for every adult still struggling with the trauma of an absent parent, pick up a copy of Hello Mom, It's Gigi. First-time author Regina Gigi Hodges walks you through a life of questions, insecurity, indifference, distrust, then finally forgiveness in her memoir detailing the longing for her absent mother. Available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and where fine books are sold.
You've written the book, and the book has been published. Now what? Beyond marketing, promoting, and sales, what are the possibilities beyond the book? Is it a podcast, an online course, a virtual event, a product line, a script for film or theater? What can you create beyond the book? That's where Pecan Tree Creative Solutions comes in. We will dive into the development lab with you to create the next great move ideal for you. Ideal based on your book. An ideal for reaching a diverse and varying audience. Reach out to Pecan Tree Creative Solutions today at www.pecanstreetbooks.com. More magic happens beyond the book.
We hope you're enjoying the show so far. Let's dive back into the Griot's Remedy from Book Loudly, a division of Pecan Tree Creative Solutions. And remember, you can always drop a comment on our Facebook or Instagram page. Look for Pecan Tree Pub.
So, heavy conversation today, but I'm loving the conversation because I think it's a necessary one, right? And I love the fact that so far we've been able to talk about the fact that this is something that our children are experiencing, sadly, in relationships. And also that we may not be handling it well in spiritual circles. And so we really mm-hmm. need to, you know, have those conversations differently in spiritual circles, right? But before the break, we started talking about creating a plan of escape. And I wonder if in creating that plan of escape, you also have to consider what happens on the other side of that? What happens if I just decide the kids and I are going to stay and ride that out, right? In my creative imagination, I think about what do I need to put in place in the event that this thing really goes south and I'm not here for my children, right? Mm-hmm. So do I need to create some type of guardianship plan? Do I need to put some legal paperwork in place to protect my children if unfortunately I'm not here, or if the situation, kind of like Val was talking about, if I decide to get a weapon and, you know, address the situation mm-hmm. in a violent manner and I end up in prison, what's going to happen with my children? Because even though that person, the abuser, may be their, you know, their biological or their legal or custodial parent, mm-hmm. do I really want my children with them?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. So let's talk about two plans that you probably really want to consider. And let's start with creating a plan of escape, because ultimately that's what I would want for mm-hmm. anybody in this type of relationship. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tangibly, what should be in a plan of escape?
A safety plan looks different for every situation mm-hmm. and is based on the resources that you have at the current moment and whether or not you can get access to more. So mm-hmm. when clients come to me and they are in a situation where they need to start creating a plan of escape before things escalate to a fatal level, the first thing that we talk about is packing some things up in a very discreet way and just mm-hmm. actually leaving them at a trusted person's house. You don't necessarily want to pack a bag and leave it packed somewhere in the house, because if the person Absolutely. Finds it and they understand that it's a getaway bag, then that's mm-hmm. going to escalate things. So before that situation even occurs, you put that bag with some personal belongings at someone else's home. And the beauty of doing that is that it forces you to have a conversation with someone outside of your home about yes. the fact that there is a problem.
Yes.
And often when you're in these situations, because of the embarrassment or the shame, or you just thinking that you're going to ride it out till it gets better, you haven't let somebody in on the reality mm-hmm. of the fact that there's some abuse or toxicity in your relationship. Mm-hmm. So creating a plan of escape is not only about making sure you can physically get away, but it's about starting to involve other people in your community who can tell you the truth and who can be there for you in the moment when things escalate and your judgment isn't so clear.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And that plan of escape, you know, I love what you said about having a bag at someone else's house, but in that also recognizing the person that you're dealing with, because sometimes we have those people that are super observant. And even if you take a yes. shirt, a shoe, they're like, they know how many shoes you have, like literally. Yep. And wow. so you can't sometimes yeah. create that bag that involves the things that you have in your house, but True. Creating that friend, that confidant that you've connected with and say, listen, I'm going to give you $10 a week. Yep. And can you buy me
this.
Can yep. you buy me a shirt? Can you, you know, and
get this for the kid?
Yep. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And get, you know, sometimes the plan or the bag may look different because of the person mm-hmm. that you're dealing with. So know who you are living with and who is, you know, inflicting this violence towards you, because you want to be safe in your escape. You don't want to, you know, have them recognizing and seeing all of your plans mm-hmm. and planning right along with you. And yes. then it becomes fatal.
And I think one of the things that was highlighted in the story, and when we talk about a plan of escape, is to not disclose where you are with the person that's abusing you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oh, that's yeah. one of the things mm-hmm. that Moni said to Val. It does no good to get a restraining order if you're going to let him in,
yeah.
if you're going to tell yeah. him where you are. Right. So that should definitely be part of your plan of escape. Where can you go that he may not find you, or that he knows find not you. To come looking, yeah. you know, for you at. And I think what Weena said is absolutely true. You got to have someone that you can trust, that you can have a conversation mm-hmm. with. Yeah. And at some point, should that conversation and your possible plan of escape include law enforcement?
I love where this is going, because as people of color, sometimes law enforcement in this country can make a situation even dicier. Oops. And so often we live in certain communities or we hold professional titles or security clearance that will make you think twice or three times about actually dialing 911 and getting law enforcement involved at any stage of the process, because you have something to lose professionally, or your partner has something to lose professionally, and it's ultimately going to impact your kids or the family in a way that is just so damaging. So law enforcement can get involved, but the best course of action is to do a little research first to understand your rights as the victim or the survivor and what they can really do to help you. Paper trails are super important before we even get law enforcement involved. If you are physically abused, document everything.
Yes.
Take pictures, photographs with your camera phone if you can. Forward them to that trusted person and then erase them so that they're not necessarily in your possession. Correct. Yes. And make sure that, of course, all of your devices are not synced up to a computer that the abuser uses, or they don't get alerts to, you know, their accounts when you're doing certain things. Or you may have to go over to that person, that trusted person's
and
house.
And let them do it.
And let them take the photographs. Absolutely. And journal. And leave that journal, or you know, write yourself a note or email digitally. And you send it off and you delete all traces of it. But you want to document the things that are happening, even if you don't get law enforcement involved or think you're going to get law enforcement involved. Because when you ultimately do have to fight for custody, or it's time to divorce and you want to prove that you've been hurt or cheated on, you're going to need that documentation, and it needs to be clear. If you're dealing with an abuser, they're one step ahead of you. They're already thinking about the cover up, the alibi, the motives. You know, they've got other people to corroborate the story.
That is so deep.
You want to make sure that when this happens, in real time, you've done what you need to do to be prepared for as best as you can.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And can part of that documentation be medical if you end up seeking medical treatment?
Absolutely, it can. Yeah. And you should seek medical treatment when you have scars, wounds, things that could potentially harm you internally, but you don't even realize it. You've been punched, right? But you see the outward bruise and you think, oh, this outward bruise is going to heal, but it also may have hurt your kidney. Right. It also may have caused some damage, you know, if you were if you had sex forcefully. You got to go get these things checked out.
Right. Yeah. Don't dismiss them.
Right. Because we don't know what's happening on the inside. Mm-hmm. We just see that this bruise is here on the outside and we learn to cover it up until it goes away. Mm-hmm. But it can leave some long-term damage that we'll regret.
Yes.
And financially, one of the things you said before, Renee, before the break was, you know, putting money away. And so I think based on what you were saying, that's also something you can do through a friend. You just give the friend the money. Like you're saying, I mean, if somebody is this controlling, certainly you can't take money from your account.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
Right.
No, because if you have a joint account.
Right. So you would have to be, you know, putting money into an account that they're totally not aware of, which means you would have to do it in a way so that they don't figure out that you're going to another bank or some type of financial institution, and you've got an account that they didn't approve.
Right.
Right. So doing that through a trusted friend is also an option.
Yes. And sometimes, I was going to say, sometimes you're going to have to leave with the clothes on your back. Mm-hmm. Sometimes abusive situations are such that financially you can't put away any extra money because you're not earning it. Or the person has found a way to make every penny that you earn a contribution to the household in some way. All of your funds are going to be tied up until the minute that you leave. And that's what keeps so many people in these situations. But fear not, that if you can get yourself away, it is quite possible for you to rebuild and work through certain support systems and also organizations that provide safe shelter and allow you to work and get on your feet, get your own cell phone, start to get your own savings and things. It's a process, but what you gain is the rest of your life.
Yes. And that goes back to what you were saying about, you know, making sure you're connected to your resources. So like the National Domestic Violence Hotline can, you know, give you a wealth of resources to help you to get on your feet. And even in confining in and having that trusted friend, you may have a friend that will fund your escape. You know, they'll say, listen, honey, don't get yourself in trouble. I'll provide you. I'm your friend. I got you. What you need? $500 to get out, you know, whatever. And so just knowing that you're not alone and that there is help out there. And that if you reach out, if you make the decision that I've had enough, because it has to be a decision, because just like in the story, you revert back when you don't make a decision. You continue to allow when you don't make a decision. Yeah. And so once you make that decision, that there are resources and help available to help you to get out.
So final thought, ladies, and I want you to kind of weigh in on this as a final thought based on our conversation about, you know, the domestic violence and how it's handled in churches or sister groups. And even in on the school level, you know, the middle school, high school, college level, right? What can, you know, if someone wants to take some type of step of activism to make sure these things are addressed in those circles, what would you suggest for them?
What I love is that at those lower levels of education, elementary school, middle school, high school, and even college, there are guidance counselors who are already employed by the institution to provide certain services. So sometimes therapy in the private sector can be cost prohibitive for some people. And when families come to me and say, oh, my child is exhibiting some of these behaviors that feel abusive or toxic, and I don't know where they came from, or my child is the victim of this abuse, what can I do? I really don't know if I can afford therapy at the moment, which is always a great option. I will direct them to their school guidance counselor because that guidance counselor is not just there twiddling their thumbs. They've got things to do, but if you don't bring things to their attention about the students that are at the school, they can't know to come and have private sessions with that student or form group discussions or whole school-wide presentations about addressing certain issues. So they are so underutilized at the high school, middle school, and elementary school level because parents sometimes don't see them as a resource because they don't necessarily solicit themselves as a resource. And at the college level, that's typically when very savvy students will start to get therapy because they do realize that there's a counseling center on their campus and their tuition has already paid for it. And they are a great first resource to therapy because they do have the power to impact you on a personal level and also put things out campus wide that help people know about these resources.
I agree, Weena, in regards to going to the school counselor and even in like once you bring the concern, the idea of the school just presenting, we present webinars and trainings and teachings on so many different topics. But again, if we target our counselor, then they can present maybe presentations that will show role play that would allow people to be able to recognize those signs because now I've seen it. Oh my goodness, that's me on that screen. That's something I'm experiencing right now. That's in my house. That's me and my boyfriend, you know, and so sometimes the children need to see, they need that visual you know, ability to learn in that way that this is not normal, that something is, you know, toxic about what I'm in right now.
And what about on the church level? How can ministries be more proactive and wise in their handling of these types of situations?
I want to applaud some of the bigger churches around the country for really pouring a lot into their youth ministries, because mm-hmm. you do have some churches whose youth ministries are led by youth pastors who right. really get it. And right. they are really trying to reach kids on their age appropriate level uh-huh. and talk about some of the harder issues, or at least create space that's safe for kids to come and actually yeah. talk about domestic violence mm-hmm. and some of these things. I think that the disparity, though, is between what's happening in the youth ministries in some of these churches and what's happening uh-huh. in the older or general ministries. Right. Right. So what the youth are getting, if parents put the youth in youth ministry, can be tremendous in terms uh-huh. of having that peer group that they can talk to about uh-huh. some of these hard things.
Yes.
But it doesn't always circulate out to the general population. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think, you know, targeting the adults, you know, is sometimes challenging because we have old ways of thinking, old mindsets,
yeah.
and those have become so migrated into the minds of the parishioners that, you know, they don't see another way. And so I think that, like you said, if we would take the young and marry it with the old, then we can grow together. You know, yeah. we can learn from one another. We can see that the way it was back in that day is not the way it is now. And that's not the things that we need to accept and we need to stand up. And so I think knowledge is key. Community is key. Coming together is a key of growth. When we keep the young separated from the old, then we make a choice not to advance. You know, we make a choice.
I love that. Because
you know, we have to marry together.
I do. And I think it's so uncommon that you see the young people having smaller circles with some of the older members of the church mm-hmm. on purpose, where everybody's voice is valued yes. in talking about the same topic. If it's yes. not a parent-child group where the families are coming specifically to address something for the kids, you don't see a church group that's coming together to talk about domestic violence, and they are literally focusing the talk to be inclusive of what young people think,
right,
and what older people think. But that is the call to action that helps people to really hear what's happening in everybody's world and have some compassion and awareness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So our call to action is, let's have some multi-generational conversations in the circles where we live.
Yes,
and church is a wonderful way to do that, right?
Yes.
A wonderful place to do that. Also, some phone numbers you should keep in hand. 211 it helps you find resources in your area across the country. Mm-hmm. The national hotline is 800-799-7233. Mm-hmm. And you can also text the word START to 88788. Mm-hmm. And if you tragically feel like it's just becoming too much for you and you're in crisis and you're thinking about suicide as a way out, please don't think about, know that your life is valuable. Know that it's valuable. You're needed here. But if that's the case, you can also dial 988, which will get mental health help involved instead of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Okay. So again, those numbers are 211 for resources in your area, 988 for suicide and crisis lifeline intervention. And the national domestic violence number is 800-799-7233, or you can text the word START to 88788. So ladies, as we wrap up today, tell everyone how they can get in touch with you, Weena.
Yes, I'm on social media, and you can always go to my website, covenanttherapy.com, covenanttherapy.com, and you'll find tons of information about my practice, but also resources and articles from mainstream magazines that will help you figure out where you are in your relationship and take some steps that will help you get to a happier, healthier place.
And Miss Renee?
You can also reach me on social media under the note of Meditational Moment. And you can visit my website at meditationalmoment.com. com, no S. And so in that, you know, coming in connection with a place that can help you to bring wholeness to your life, to be able to walk in joy and peace and love.
So don't forget, thank you so much for listening in this episode. We hope you got a lot of valuable information. And just remember that you can definitely put a plan to leave in action, a safety plan in place. And if you do choose to stay, remember, one of the things you definitely want to consider is putting a plan in place to make sure your children are taken care of in the event something should happen to you. I know that's a hard thing to hear, but it's a very real reality in domestic violence situations. So wherever you're listening from, Facebook, Instagram, on the Book Loudly page, on the Buzzsprout page, make sure you drop us comments or shoot us an email, because we definitely want to interact with you. And we want to make sure if you missed any of the resource information this episode, we get that to you as quickly as possible. Next week's episode is going to be hilarious and full of wisdom. It's called Smooth Like Batter. And as I always say, to be in the know, be sure you're listening. I will talk to you guys next week, ladies.
Bye.
See ya.
This has been another creatively powerful and engaging version of The Griot's Remedy. Be sure to tune in next week for a new episode, new insight, and discussion that gives you some things to consider as you take a look in your proverbial mirror. The Griot's Remedy, where fiction mirrors real life and everything is up for discussion. Your host is E. Claudette Freeman, editor-producer MJ Smith. Production company Book Loudly, part of Pecan Tree Creative Solutions. Email us at bookloudly@pecantreebooks.com or find us at www.pecantreebooks.com.
The Griot's Remedy, produced by Book Loudly, a division of Pecan Tree Creative Solutions, is designed to be an entertaining and insightful creative exploration of life issues through the lenses of characters written in fiction and creative nonfiction stories and excerpts or full versions of scripts written for the stage or film. Thoughts, comments, and observations by the host, coaches, counselors, and therapists are not to be construed as personal advice or direction. The host, coaches, counselors, and therapists are also not offering and will not offer mental health advice specific to a listener's individual life or situation, but are sharing individual thoughts and observations. If the themes discussed in this segment resonate with you, we strongly recommend you seek the advice of a licensed mental health care professional or a licensed life coach or life strategist. Visit the podcast site at bookloudly@pecantreebooks.com for resources related to the themes highlighted in this segment.